is jury duty really that bad? Is it really that bad, as some may say? Now, first of all, the funny thing is that virtually no one likes to serve on a jury. At the same time, we are being told by official reports that the vast majority of people agree to the jury system, that that's actually a tremendously important and great system to have. But the vast majority of people, when they actually be summoned, like to get out of it. They don't want to serve. They consider it a great inconvenience. They raise all kinds of excuses. Some valid, some not so valid, to avoid having to serve. And because of this development, which has apparently increased quite a bit recently, courts have become more and more reluctant to excuse someone from jury duty service. And looking at their point of view, you can perhaps understand that, because if everybody comes and has some kind of a flimsy excuse for not to serve, then judges get more and more frustrated with the whole system. Now, there are some jurisdictions still which do excuse for certain reasons. Normally, it's undue hardship. It could include financial hardship. Not every jurisdiction does excuse any longer for financial hardship. But they sometimes do. They sometimes do because of age. If you're old enough to walk around with crutches or in a wheelchair, then you have a good chance you might be excused. However, some jurisdictions do it automatically once you have reached a certain age. Some jurisdictions still require that you have to have some physical handicap. Some jurisdictions require you provide a doctor's certificate. The one thing, however, which virtually all the jurisdictions now have refused to excuse you for automatically is religious conviction. Now, if you have a religious conviction preventing you from serving on a jury, and if that's all you got, then clerks today normally reject that request outright. And they say the juror, the potential juror, has to come to court and has to talk to the judge on the summoned day. It used to be different, and I'll mention that in a few minutes, but right now I'd like to point out that when you get a summons, to simply ignore it is dangerous. It's extremely dangerous because more and more judges have now issued bench warrants for your arrest. If you have a summons, the paper summons you to appear on a certain date, you just don't show up. Judges have now begun to issue warrants for your arrest. Recently, a Texas case was reported where a person didn't show up for jury duty. He was years later stopped by the police because of speeding. And the police found out, and they have these computerized equipments, that there was this outstanding warrant for his arrest. He was immediately arrested and jailed. Ended up in jail, and ended up there for a long time. Why? Because the judge who had originally issued the warrant had retired. The new judge had this big, huge paperwork in front of him and had never looked at it, and the poor guy didn't have the money to post a bail. Now, this didn't happen in China, in Russia. That happened in the United States of America, in Texas. But I dare to say it wouldn't happen just only in Texas. Now, there are ways to approach a judge in order to get excused from jury duty, and there are also other ways how not to do it. Let me give you, to begin with, an example how not to do it. This actually is an affidavit. In other words, this is the state of Montana. And over there, you can file an affidavit sending that to the judge and explaining to the judge why you don't serve or why don't you want to serve on a jury. And now this particular one apparently only allows an excuse for undue hardship. And so this person was now asked to explain what his undue hardship was. Notice what he is writing. However, I have to bleep certain things out. So every time I use the word bleep, you can figure there is a certain word I don't want to quote. So that's what he wrote. Apparently, you morons didn't understand me the first time. I cannot take time off from work. I'm not putting my family's well-being at stake in to participate in this bleep. I don't believe in our justice, quote-unquote, system, and I don't want to have a bleep thing to do with it. Jury duty is a complete waste of time. I would rather count the bleep on my bleep than sit on a jury. Get it through your thick skulls. Leave me the bleep alone. Now, you can imagine when the judge got that affidavit, he wasn't very happy. In fact, he was considering immediately holding the person in contempt and throwing him into jail. So what the person then did do, finally, he went to the court and apologized very humbly for the affidavit and debated the issue with the judge and actually was excused. However, I wouldn't recommend that you go about that way. But there are ways you can and should go about it. Now, first of all, let us consider that jury duty is mandatory. It's not a voluntary thing. It's mandatory. If you are an American citizen, you must serve on the jury unless you have valid reasons to be excused. I have here a state bar pamphlet from the State Bar of California entitled, What Should I Know About Serving on a Jury? Let me just read to you very briefly a few excerpts from it. Question, how are potential jurors picked? See, that's always a question people ask. How do they even get my name? And some have some misconceptions about that. Notice what they all are using. They are randomly selected from voter registration lists, Department of Motor Vehicles lists, telephone directories, and utility company lists. So that doesn't exclude too many people, right? Somehow you are on the phone book, or you might have some utility services, so you're right there in the mix. Next question, if I receive a summons for jury duty, do I have to respond? Answer, yes. Citizens must respond when summoned for jury service. Even if you may not qualify for service, you must respond to the summons. If you do not, you could be held in contempt of court and be fined or sent to jail. Next question, if I have a good excuse, can I get out of jury service? Answer, it depends. Jury service is not voluntary. It is your civic duty, and the law only allows you to be excused for certain reasons. So let's keep it in mind. It is your duty to prove to the judge that you should be excused, not the other way around. As I said, it used to be different. In the past, it was sufficient to write a letter explaining your religious convictions, using some scriptures perhaps, and referring to some case law, and the clerk would automatically excuse you if he felt that your approach was sincere. We used to have in the Worldwide Church of God a situation where the court, specifically in Pasadena and in Los Angeles, had a list of organizations, knowing that those organizations were preaching against serving on the jury. And so the Worldwide Church of God was on that list. And when one of the members received a summons, they would go to their minister, and the minister would just send in a letter to the court saying, and he would confirm that this member or person is a member in good standing, and then the clerk would automatically excuse that person because they understood that they were religiously opposed to serving on the jury. That's no longer the case. No such lists of quote-unquote accepted organizations exist any longer. Now it is up to the individual to plead his case. Why is that so? Why has it become so difficult for two members of the Church of God to be excused from serving on the jury because of religious reasons? Simply because, I would suggest to you, we have reached the end of the age when Satan's wrath against God and true Christians has become very great. When you send in a letter today to the court, which I have recently done because I got a summons, and I wrote a very sophisticated, lengthy letter with all kinds of attachments to them, They send it all right back to you, together with a form letter, something like that. It's just a total form letter. It's pretty much identical. Some others have gotten the same kind of a form letter. It only has an item on top where they put in the date, and then they put in your batch number, and then somebody signs it, normally a jury commissioner or deputy jury commissioner. And that's what that letter says. Dear citizen, thank you for responding to the summons for jury service. This letter is intended to notify you that your request to be excused from jury service cannot be granted. Personal beliefs, biases, or experiences do not exempt you from serving as a prospective juror. If you are sent to a courtroom as a juror, you will have an opportunity to raise this issue during the jury selection process in the courtroom. Please report as instructed on the reporting date indicated on the summons for jury service. And then they give you the opportunity to postpone it if it's convenient, and I believe you can postpone it or reschedule it twice. Now, the interesting thing is, as I said, that was not the procedure several years ago. And I represented some members and helped them, tried to help them to get out of jury duty service because of their religious convictions. And so I sent letters in on their behalf with case law and also their letter talking about their religious convictions. One time I got a call from the head clerk of one particular court. And he said to me, "Mr. Link, if it were up to me, I would have excused your client a long time ago. But it's not up to me, because I don't have any longer anything to say in the matter. These matters, when it comes to religious excuses, are transferred to the legal department of the court. And they are making the decisions. And their decisions are basically no, can't do it." And so they drag the person to court to talk to the judge. Now, that his comment to me was absolutely correct is evidenced by the fact that I received such a letter from the legal department of that court. In this particular case of this county of San Diego, it's by the Office of Court Counsel. This was in response to some of my letters I wrote in defense of some of our church members. And so they wrote me back in 2007, and that's what they wrote. "Please note that California law does not include a disqualification or an excuse or exemption from jury service due to religious convictions." Goes on to say, under California Code of Civil Procedure, Section 204, an eligible person may be excused from jury service only for undue hardship. If a prospective juror is assigned to a courtroom, that individual will have an opportunity to raise additional issues or requests during the jury selection process. And then they sent me a 20 or so page operational policy manual, which became effective in 2007. So they say, "References in both of your letters to past practices in San Diego County do not apply." Because I pointed out that that particular person had been excused twice by the same court before for religious reasons. To say it doesn't apply anymore. They went on to say, "The cases cited in your letters have been reviewed and either are not on point and or not controlling authority in California." Problem is, the cases I quoted interpret the United States Constitution saying that somebody who is religiously opposed to serving on a jury has a constitutional right not to. So what the San Diego court is telling me here, they don't care about that. They don't care about the Constitution. They only care about their internal procedures. As I said, clerks don't even read letters anymore which ask for excuses for religious convictions. Many times they just send a letter back with all the material which they were sent saying they can't excuse. Now then let me ask you this question. Why is serving and deliberating and rendering judgment in a jury case so bad for true Christians? Or is it? Now, first of all, let me point out what you must do when you are going down to court, which, unless you have other excuses, you will have to. And what you will also have to do if you are selected as a juror. Here's a pamphlet from the Judicial Council of California. And even though in other jurisdictions it might slightly vary, it's basically the same procedure. It says, when a jury trial is about to begin, the trial court judge requests a panel of prospective jurors to be sent to the courtroom from the jury assembly room so that the jury selection process can begin. After reporting to a courtroom, the prospective jurors are first required to swear, now they allow affirmation, that they will truthfully answer all questions asked about their qualifications to serve as jurors in the case. Now, that's not too bad. Here is actually the wording of that particular affirmation oath. Do you and each of you understand and agree that you will accurately and truthfully answer, under penalty of perjury, all questions propounded to you concerning your qualifications and competency to serve as a trial juror in the matter pending before the court, and that failure to do so may subject you to criminal prosecution? So in other words, you're just being asked, are you willing to answer the questions which are being asked you now correctly and truthfully? But now comes the problem. See, the judge and the attorneys ask jurors questions to determine if the jurors are free of bias or prejudice, or whether there's any other reason why they cannot be fair and impartial. When the selection of the jury is completed, the jurors take the following oath or affirmation. Do you and each of you understand and agree that you will well and truly try the cause now pending before this court and a true verdict render according only to the evidence presented to you and to the instructions of the court? And then this pamphlet even went on to say, as a juror, you should think seriously about the oath before taking it. The oath means you give your words to reach your verdict upon only the evidence presented in the trial and the court's instructions about the law. You cannot consider any other evidence and instruction other than those given by the court in the case before you. And later they emphasize that part again when you are in deliberation and reach a verdict. They say, in your efforts to reach a verdict, keep in mind that you should consider only the evidence that was presented in the courtroom. Now, what this means, and what cases have decided it to mean, you cannot in any way consider the Bible. You cannot in any way look at biblical principles. You cannot in any way quote the Bible. There was one case where a lady actually brought the Bible into the deliberation room and started to read scriptures. Can't do that. Violation of your oath you gave under perjury. So the point is, if you are a juror and you are selected a juror, you are telling and promising the court you will only look at the evidence presented, you will only listen to the instructions of the judge, you will not look at anything else. In other words, you will obey man under every circumstance, and you will not obey God if there's a conflict. In fact, you are told that your own conscience has to stay outside the deliberation room. You cannot judge based on your conscience. You can only judge based on what the judge told you and what the evidence was which was presented. Now, again, unless you have other valid legal reasons for not serving on a jury, like hardship, like you are too old, or they have to take care of somebody, or you have been a peace officer, or that sort of thing, you must have a religious conviction based on the Bible, which prevents you from serving. Because if you don't have a religious conviction, even under God's law, you would have to serve. You see, inconvenience, oh, I don't like to, that's not enough. Notice what God tells us in Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13, beginning in verse 1. It says in Romans 13 and verse 1, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities. For there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Verse 2. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God, and those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. Verse 5. Therefore, you must be subject, not only because of wrath of the authorities, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for they are God's ministers attending continually to this very thing. Render therefore to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs are due, fear to whom fear is due, honor to whom honor is due, jury service to whom jury service is due, unless you have a clear-cut command by God not to do it. Now, as good citizens, we are doing everything what we ought to do, except for those few things which are in violation to God's commandments, in the literal and, of course, in the spiritual application. See, we are even to pray for our leaders in government so that we can live quiet lives, as it says in the Bible, so that we can do the work of God unhindered. See, we have the privilege still, who knows for how long, but at this point, to do the work of God here in the United States of America and in other countries. But we are prevented from doing so in certain communist countries, as you all know. I mean, they cannot even circulate Bibles to people, and they will be arrested for that. And so we can take advantage of the benefits of being a citizen of our country, and we give back what we ought to, including, as we read, paying our taxes, as long as what we are doing doesn't violate God's laws. Think of the Apostle Paul. See, the Apostle Paul was a Roman citizen. He took advantage of the privileges of being a Roman citizen when he pleaded to go to Caesar. He didn't want to be tried by the Jews in Jerusalem because he knew that would have been a preconceived situation and they would have, of course, probably stoned him or killed him or executed him, whatever. So he realized that. So he asked for a change of venue, if you want to use legal terms today. And he was able to do that because he was a Roman citizen. But one thing Paul never did. Paul never compromised with God's law. And even when he stood in front of his accusers and governmental officials, he didn't shy back from telling them why he was wrongfully accused. And he didn't shy back from telling them that he was accused because he was preaching the resurrection from the dead, which the Sadducees didn't believe in. As I said, you have to have a religious conviction to be excused from jury duty service. It can't be a matter of inconvenience only. When the Worldwide Church of God began to make all those changes, all these doctrinal changes, and by now probably they have reached the point where they don't teach anything anymore, and I mean that literally, which we at one time believed. So it shouldn't come as a surprise that, of course, they did away with not having to serve on the jury. So they felt, you know, that was fine. It was fine to go to war. It was fine to vote in governmental elections, whatever it was. But then one of the leaders came to the legal department and said, okay, can you help me? I got a summons. And so he was asked, well, you know, do you have sincere religious convictions against serving on the jury? He said, oh, no. I just don't want to go. Well, that's not sufficient. I'm sorry. Just a matter of inconvenience is not an issue. That's not anything you can get excused for, and you shouldn't even try. You have to have a religious conviction, and that conviction must be based on the Bible. Now, personal experiences can help you form your biblical conviction. But the key is, before you can express your conviction to the judge, you have to have one. I mean, you cannot tell the judge about your personal conviction unless you have a personal conviction. And that personal conviction must be sincere, and it must be genuine. And when you have a sincere religious conviction, which is based on the Bible, or at least which is not contrary to the Bible, you cannot violate that. Because if you do, you sin. Notice Romans chapter 14 and verse 23. Romans chapter 14 and verse 23. He who doubts is condemned. In this particular case, if he eats meat sacrificed to idols, but the principle applies to all walks of life. If you doubt when you do something, you are condemned, because whatever is not from faith is sin. So if you violate your conviction, you sin in the eyes of God. So you really have no choice. Either you are willing to disobey God if you have a religious conviction against serving, or you are willing to disobey man. And of course, if there is a conflict, you have to obey God rather than man. And if your conviction is rejected by the judge, you still have to submit. But then you have to submit to the penalty which he imposes on you. You know, many years ago, when I just started practicing law in Germany, I had to defend a member who at that time had to stand up for his religious conviction against serving in the military. See, now it's easy in Germany right now. In other words, if you have religious convictions against serving, you just fill out a postcard and send it back and say, I'm a conscientious objector, and it's accepted. At that time, that wasn't the case. You had to appear in front of a draft board, and you had to prove your sincere religious conviction. That was the same here in this country when we had the draft. And let me tell you, if you get the draft again, which we probably will, it's going to be the same again. You have to appear in front of a draft board, and you have to prove to them that you have a religious conviction. And so in Germany, this particular member tried to tell the draft board in an administrative capacity, and they flunked him. And then he appealed to the administrative higher level, and they flunked him. And so now he has his last recourse, and that is to go to court, and the court would have to make the final decision. At that point, I got involved in the case, and we appeared in front of the court. And this was a court consisting of three judges. One judge extremely hostile, one judge fairly minded. And so the extremely hostile judge tried to corner the church member. And the church member had made the case as to why he believed it was wrong to kill in war and to go to the military service in a combatant capacity. And he gave certain answers. And he always would give the same answers in all three different levels. And the judge tried to ridicule those answers and to say, oh, this is just nonsense. I mean, how can you say this? And he tried him to change his answers, and he wouldn't. And so then finally the presiding judge stopped the whole procedure and he said, look, I am now convicted and convinced that you are religiously convicted of your position. And the reason I say that is because you could have easily changed your testimony. When you notice that the administrative boards tried to make fun of you, and that even my colleague here tried to make fun of you, you could have changed, but you didn't. And you stuck to your gun. And that proves to me that your statements are religiously motivated and that you are sincere about your case. The point is, the member had to face two possibilities. He either had to go to jail, because if he would have lost that case, they would have gotten him into jail. And this was peacetime. If it was wartime, they would have killed him. Or to go into the military. His conviction was, I can't go into the military. He stuck to his gun, so to speak, and he prevailed. Now, I believe he prevailed because God intervened. God helped us out in this case. But he couldn't violate his conviction because it was based on the Bible. He would have sinned if he had done anything else. By the way, I still have contact with this member. He lives in Australia now. And if he listens to the sermon or hears it later, I'd like to commend you for your strong stance on the matter. Now, some have said, 7, 8, 9 years ago, actually, when we started the Church of the Eternal God, because there were many issues which prevented us from merging with another group, somebody wrote me and said, oh, you make it out to be as if jury duty is an unpardonable sin. And I wrote him back and said, oh, I never said that. I don't believe that. But it is a sin. It is a sin. Now, some church groups are saying today, well, they don't excuse us anymore for religious reasons, so our members should just serve on the jury. And some do. That's wrong. That's the wrong approach. That's the wrong approach by the organizations, And that's the wrong approach by the members. You see, the same could be said about all kinds of things, like serving in the military in a combatant capacity. What if your conviction prevents you from doing that? Do you just give in? Where do you stop? How far are you willing to go? You know, Mr. Armstrong has always said, if you start compromising in a little area, even if it's just a little, it will lead to you compromising in another area, and in another, and in another, and in another. And it will become an avalanche you cannot stop. So again, let me reemphasize, you need to have a conscience. You need to have a conscientious conviction which is based on the Bible and biblical principles and which prevent you from serving on a jury. And once you have that conviction, and that has to be your personal conviction, you've got to be totally convinced of it. You have to have studied the scriptures and literature which we have provided, which hopefully help us to better understand the scriptures. Once you have that conviction, then comes the next step. You've got to be able to explain your conviction to the judge. Notice in 1 Peter chapter 3. 1 Peter chapter 3, beginning in verse 14. Even if you should suffer for righteousness' sake, you are blessed. And do not be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and always be ready to give a defense to everyone who asks you a reason for the hope that is in you, with meekness and fear, having a good conscience. Not a conscience which is compromised, a good conscience. That when they defame you as evildoers, what, you are not going to serve on the jury? What kind of a person are you? Are you not a patriot? Are you not supporting the laws of the land? If they defame you as evildoers, those who revile your good conduct in Christ, because it's good conduct in Christ if you follow Christ's lead, they may be ashamed, ultimately. Not right away, but ultimately when their awakening comes. But you know, some are better in explaining their convictions, what they believe, than others. Some, when they are confronted by a judge or by a magistrate, they have a hard time expressing themselves. Well, I would say don't be overly alarmed and frightened when you are called in to explain your convictions to a judge. But remember that you have God's help. Well, certainly pray to God ahead of time and ask Him to give you the wisdom to say the right things and also give you favor in the eyes of the judge. And then remember what Christ promises us in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, beginning in verse 11. Luke chapter 12, beginning in verse 11. Now when they bring you to the synagogues and magistrates and authorities, do not worry about how or what you should answer or what you should say. For the Holy Spirit will teach you in that very hour what you ought to say. Also in the same book, chapter 21, beginning in verse 13. It will turn out for you as an occasion for testimony. That's Luke 21, beginning in verse 13. Now verse 14. Therefore settle it in your hearts not to meditate beforehand on what you will answer, for I will give you a mouth and wisdom which all your adversaries will not be able to contradict or resist. And so we have to have that belief that God will help us to find the right words and not to write an affidavit like I quoted earlier. That's not the way to do it. But to ask God for help. And here is a promise which Christ has given us. He says, I will help you. And I will help you to find the right words. Now, there is still no guarantee that the result is you are going to get off the hook. But at least there is a guarantee that you find the right words to express your conviction as good as possible. Now, there are many biblical reasons not to serve on the jury. And there are just too many to discuss here, and this is not the purpose of my sermon today anyhow, because I have another purpose. But we have several Q&As available, and I'd just like to briefly mention them to you. You can easily find them by just going to our website, and when you have the search engine, you just plug the questions in or some keywords, and you get them all. I pulled them all the other day, and it took me less than 10 minutes to do so. Here's one. The question is, what are the biblical principles enjoining us not to serve on a jury? What are the biblical principles enjoining us not to serve on the jury? Another one, is it correct that we in the United States cannot be excused from jury duty for religious reasons? Therefore, we must serve on the jury even though we are conscientiously opposed to doing so and might otherwise face contempt in jail. That's what one church organization is preaching. Is that true? So this Q&A answers that one. Another one, I understand that you teach that Christians serving on a jury can only convict an accused if at least two eyewitnesses testify against him. But doesn't modern science, such as evidence based on DNA or fingerprints, render that ancient biblical command obsolete, which was given at a time when people had no concepts of modern scientific advancements? So here we go in the issue. God says you cannot convict anyone except you have two witnesses. In fact, you cannot even judge a case unless you have two witnesses. And so we are saying two witnesses means two witnesses. It doesn't mean scientific circumstantial evidence. Here's another one. In a recent Q&A, you said that the Bible requires the testimony of two eyewitnesses to convict a person, but this seems to be incorrect. The scriptures talk about witnesses who are testifying before the judge, not persons witnessing a crime with their eyes. Therefore, it seems that two witnesses could testify to scientific evidence or circumstances to establish a connection with a crime, including DNA, fingerprints, blood strain, or similar evidence. What do you think? You see what the question is. The question is, you don't need two witnesses who actually witnessed the crime. You only need two witnesses who can testify to circumstantial evidence. Is that true? Answer is no. The Q&A answers that one based on the Bible again. And then here's a related one. Does the New Testament say that we should not swear, but that we are allowed to affirm? Is it advisable to raise our right hand when affirming? Now, this comes into play even when you go down to the jury duty room and they ask you to swear or affirm that you will tell the truth should you raise your right hand when you do that. What does the Bible say about that? And, of course, then there is one more, which was actually published in today's update, and that's the one, the Q&A on the death penalty. What does the Bible say about that? And could you, as a juror, agree to convicting someone to death today? Okay, you might want to look at that one too. One point to keep in mind in looking at all these different issues is that we have to follow the lead of Jesus Christ. And we have to do this in all walks of life. We have to live like he lived. And notice, Jesus Christ refused to get involved in judging civil and criminal matters. Notice first in Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12, beginning in verse 13. You can easily apply this to a jury duty service situation. Because here come two people and ask Christ to judge for them. Luke 12, verse 13. Then one from the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Civil case. He doesn't want to share the inheritance with me. You tell him. Notice verse 14. He said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" Flatly refused to get involved. He also flatly refused to get involved judging a criminal matter. In June chapter 8. I'm sorry, in John. Did I say June? I don't know how I said June. I meant John. John chapter 8, beginning in verse 3, a very famous passage. Let's read it again in context. John chapter 8, beginning in verse 3. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned, but what do you say?" This they said, testing him that they might have something of which to accuse him. Now, Why? In what way would they have had something to accuse him? Well, you see, either way, if Christ would have said, okay, she should be stoned, then they would have come back and said, yeah, but Master, the law says we have to bring you the woman and the man. Both got to be stoned. See, that was one part of the conspiracy and of the hypocrisy. And if he would have said, no, she doesn't need to be stoned, then they would have said, yeah, but you are violating the law of Moses, who commanded us to stone that person. So they thought they had him. They thought they had caught him. They tricked him. There was no way out for Christ. What did Christ do? Verse 6, this they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he didn't hear, didn't even answer, didn't even get involved. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, he didn't say, okay, this woman should be stoned. He didn't say this woman shouldn't be stoned. He said to them, he who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their own conscience. Now again, there's all kinds of speculation as to what Christ might have written down on the ground. He must have written down something. In any event, the people who were accusing this woman, when Christ said, if you are without sin, cast the first stone, they knew they were not without sin. Now, maybe Christ wrote down their sins. Maybe Christ wrote down the names of the people. I don't know what he wrote down. It was enough and it was sufficient for the people to be convicted by their own conscience that they were not without sin, so therefore they walked out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last. And Jesus was left alone and the woman standing in the midst. Now, the accusers were gone. Verse 10, and when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, woman, Where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you? And so she said, no one, Lord. And Jesus said to her, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. Again, he didn't condone the sin, but he didn't render a judgment of condemnation in a criminal case. He flatly refused to do it. And that is definitely in line with what Paul told the church. Paul told us, the Apostle Paul that is, not to judge, not to condemn those who are outside the church. Now he expected that the church judge or administer matters within its jurisdiction. But he made it very clear that we are not to get involved in condemning and judging those outside the church. Notice 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, beginning in verse 12. He says, for what have I to do with judging those also who are outside? Do you not judge those who are inside? But those who are outside, God judges. He makes it very clear to the brethren here, don't judge those outside. Why? Why should we get involved in it? Well, simply because the Bible considers this present world as an evil world, ruled by Satan, the devil. You see, this is not God's world. This has never been God's world ever since Adam and Eve committed the sin of disobedience and all the other things they did, as we heard in the sermonette. Since this is Satan's world, and every country, I don't care which one you may mention, is under the rule of Satan, that would include all our governmental and judicial systems. All of them were created by man under Satan's inspiration. Now, when you hear of a person who has been convicted and has been in jail for 10, 15, 20 years, and then evidence is presented, DNA, whatever it may be, showing that the person was innocent, and then he was released because he was incorrectly convicted. Then I hear those funny newspaper reporters and newscasters and commentators say, oh yeah, the system works. The person was freed after all. Well, I agree. Satan's system worked. But it's not God's system. You see, if it were God's system, that person wouldn't have been convicted in the first place. If you say the system works by looking at a person who was in jail innocently for 20 or whatever years, it's a joke. Unless you recognize that you are talking about the system of Satan. You know, Satan needs to be organized too. He needs to have a system too in order to prevail, in order to cope. Remember when Jesus cast out demons with the power of the Holy Spirit? He was accused by the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes saying, oh, he is casting out the devil by the devil. And then Jesus said, well, if I cast out Satan with Satan, then how can his kingdom endure? He wasn't saying his kingdom wasn't enduring. He knew it would endure until the time when Christ comes back. So Satan has to have a system too which works. But it's a satanic system. So the devil makes a mistake to believe that this is God's world, and so that we can participate in the judicial and governmental system of this world. Paul makes this even clearer in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, because he asks the question, why would you actually bring a lawsuit against your brother or your sister by going to the courts of this world? You shouldn't have anything to do with that. The church judge it, but you don't go outside and go to the courts of this world. But notice how he uses the wording. Maybe you've never noticed this quite before. In 1 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, he doesn't mince any words here. He says, dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints. Do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? He's talking about the same thing he's talked about earlier, that you should take care of matters within the church pertaining to church members. But leave those who are outside alone. He goes on to say in verse 3, do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? Verse 4, if then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, notice, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge? He's talking about the judges of this world. Least esteemed by the church. He calls them unrighteous. How can we be part of this in a jury duty service? Next verse, verse 5, I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not a wise man among you, not even one, who will be able to judge between his brethren? But brother goes to law against brothers, and that before unbelievers. Brethren, if we understand only that point, that this is not God's world, and that the judges of this world are not the ones who are rendering righteous judgments, then we have already the answer why we can't possibly be part of the system. I wanted to share a lot of personal experiences with you, and I still will do that, but, you know, time is fleeting. Again, I'd like to ask Mr. Bannon to give me a sign when I have reached the hour mark, because I was involved in the legal system for a long time. And I'd like to share some of that with you because it helped me a lot to appreciate better what Paul is saying here, what the Bible is teaching, why we cannot be and should not be as true Christians involved in the system. You see, when I studied law in Germany, over there they require two exams. First, the one you go to university and then you get a theoretical exam. But then after that, you have a two-year practical training, so to speak, where you're being assigned to a judge and a district attorney and an attorney of law, and then also you have to work for the city for a while. And after the two-year practical training, then you had to also take another exam. And so during this time, I was also sitting in, listening to the judgments of the superior court judge I was assigned to, and also later then to the deliberations and the judgments of the Court of Appeals, consisting of three judges. And if I had any illusions about judges are really interested in getting to a righteous judgment, these illusions were gone. because I listened to their rationale. Oh, well, I don't like that attorney. I don't think he should win that case. What can we do to make sure he loses? Now, these are my personal experiences. I know that there are attorneys in other churches who would probably strongly disagree with me. They probably didn't have those experiences. But I'm just telling you where I'm coming from. I'm telling you what I experienced. And I'm telling you why that brought home the statements you find in the Bible about not serving in the judicial system. Because early on I decided I could never be a judge. I most certainly could never be a district attorney. But I did practice as an attorney for a while over there in Germany. And then when I came over here, I also practiced law, and I'm still licensed to practice. However, as you probably know, I haven't practiced really a lot. First of all, because my duties in the church prevent me from doing so, and secondly, I have serious problems with much of what's going on. I'm helping church members still have problems, but that's pretty much the extent of it. I also, at one time, had to represent the district attorney. And here was a guy who was accused of possession and use of hashish. And he was a repeated offender. He had been found having that in possession first. And then they told him he can't do that, but he had become addicted by it. And so he was found again. Not that he actually sold it, but he did use it. And so I was sent over there to represent the district attorney and to tell the judge what I think would be a fair judgment in the case. And I felt very uncomfortable about that. Because the guy was seriously sorry on the one hand, but he couldn't help himself. I mean, he needed help, but the help was not getting a judgment by the court condemning him to jail. And on top of that, after we heard the case, we walked outside and we had a 5 or 10 minute recess and before we would go back in. And then everybody there, whether it was a judge or whether it was the state representative who was there and some other people, they were all smoking. Now, by that time, I had already learned that smoking is wrong. Smoking is wrong because it's hazardous to your health. There is no purpose to smoke except for selfish reasons. In fact, we also knew a little bit already about passive smoking, and we understood that passive smokers can get sick and even probably even more so than those who smoke. Mr. Armstrong had explained it very clearly, that it's not in accordance with the way of love, it's in accordance with the way of get, and it's wrong. It's sin. So I look at these people who smoke, but it's legal, so they could do it. And so I thought, well, this is hypocritical, I mean, this is ridiculous. So I went back, and when I was asked to say what I felt, I asked for the minimum sentence under the law. The judge didn't accept that. He gave him a higher sentence, which I thought was wrong. But I also said very clearly, because you see, you guys are all smoking. That's wrong. You know you are damaging your health in doing so. See, my father, who died when he was 95 years old, was a heavy smoker. But when he was 50, he was called in by the doctor because all his brothers were dying of cancer, lung cancer, all kinds of cancers. And the doctor told him, well, look, if you keep smoking, you're next. You're going to die. And so he had a strong mind, and so he stopped smoking. From one minute to the next, now he got sick like a dog, he got all kinds of pills, you know, he had to take, but he stopped, and has never touched it ever since. You know, they say if you smoke, it takes up to 10 years, and sometimes even longer, for the organs you have damaged through your smoking to recuperate. Now, he was able to do that, and he died when he was 95. So I knew all these things, not that he died when he was 95, but the fact that he had to stop smoking because all his brothers had died of cancer. And so I made that point. Of course, it didn't help, and that frustrated me quite a bit because I didn't think it was the right decision, and the judge didn't seem to care at all. He didn't say, oh, yeah, you're right, Mr. Ling, I will stop smoking now. No, that wasn't the reaction at all. When I came here to the United States, because I came to the conclusion over there, if I have to do that for the rest of my life, that's not what I want to do with my life. To rush from court trial and to... Well, I mean, I would make a lot of money. I was working for an attorney who had no child, and he wanted me to become his partner, and in the meantime, he died, and so I would have taken over the practice, and I would be a rich man, perhaps. But I knew that wasn't it for me. And so when the opportunity arose to come over here and to work in the legal department, I jumped on that, thinking, wow, now I have found heaven on earth. Well, before I left, a minister in Germany told me, well, Norbert, you are going to the most dangerous place on earth. I said, why are you saying that? He said, because you are going to find out things not many people will find out about people others would not believe. And you've got to be very strong that you stay in the church. You know, I didn't think the guy knew what he was talking about. But I have to say, I learned a lot of things about a lot of people. But it has never caused me to leave the church. And the reason is because I didn't come into the church because of people. See, when I came into the church, I didn't know anybody. I came into the church because I had learned from our literature that that was the correct teaching based on the Bible. That's why I came, and that's why I left the Worldwide Church of God when they started to teach the opposite to what the Bible teaches. But nevertheless, I was heavily involved in many lawsuits while we were here. Let me ask Mr. Ben, how long can I go to get it all on the disc? 10 more minutes? Wow. Maybe this is going to be a part two. I'd like to just mention a few real quick. One was the lawsuit by the Attorney General of the State of California, Mr. Duke Majan, against the Worldwide Church of God, which started in 79. Now, I came in 81, but the lawsuit was still ongoing. And then later we had to battle with the insurance company, so I had to pretty much look into everything which had happened. And this was an absolutely unconstitutional lawsuit from the outset. The judges got together. The district attorney's office, the attorney general, got together. They were all in cahoots with some disgruntled ministers who filed the lawsuit. These were the relators, as they were called, based on wrong and faulty affidavits. The government took over the premises of the Worldwide Church of God without prior notice, in total violation of the law, up to the point where they charged Mr. Armstrong and some others of pilfering money. That was the basis for which they came in. And then they gave themselves huge salaries for their services. Later, 2 years later, about 2.5 years later, the Court of Appeals decided that this was an unconstitutional action. It was infirm, constitutionally infirm from the outset and destined to failure. But this was 2 years later, 2.5. So people say, oh yeah, the system worked. Look, if the church wouldn't have had the money, unfortunately we did, they would have been history. I mean, who has the money to fight a lawsuit for 2.5 years against the district attorney of the state of California? I mean, they had to hire people like Professor Tribe from the Harvard University, who helped us. Now, he is the one who is now one of the advisors to President Obama. Now, he wasn't cheap, and others weren't cheap. You see, it was an absolute satanic attack, and being in the courts or listening later to what was all discussed and decided, if I had any confidence in the legal systems here in California, and for that matter in the United States, or for that matter around the world, that confidence was long gone. We had another situation. We had a case where a former wife sued the church, Mr. Armstrong, others, for a conspiracy to commit libel and defamation against her. The judge was an atheist, and we later learned, he said, oh, I'm going to have a ball with that church. The jury was highly inflamed, and we ended up with a judgment against us for $1.26 million. Well, we obviously appealed the case. However, the insurance company figured, well, you know, it was too expensive to defend that case, so they settled. So we never won the case. We never lost the case in the sense that we didn't have to pay this lady any money. And by the way, I think it was a frivolous lawsuit. The judgment which was rendered was absolutely false under the law. But nevertheless, she won. She got a lot of money from the insurance company. There are many other cases I could talk to you about where judges absolutely don't seem to have a clue when it comes to the Constitution. They don't care. One time, we were ordered to produce documents, highly sensitive, confidential documents, relating to a divorce situation where we gave counsel, and so the other side wanted to get those documents because they wanted to look at the names of those counseling sessions so that you could sue each and every one of them. And we said, well, no, this is absolutely privileged. The law is absolutely clear on that. No, we're not going to give them out. The judge said, I'm going to hold you in contempt if you don't. Didn't care about the Constitution at all. Story goes longer. I could tell you how I finally got out of it. It happened in Colorado. At the time, I said I never, ever will set foot in Colorado again. Well, I changed my mind later on that one. But the system over there, I can't recommend. There's another case where when we were licensed to practice here in Superior Court, we were then brought into federal court because there we had to be admitted and the sponsor had to be sponsoring us. And so we were just asked then to give an affirmation that we would, you know, practice faithfully in federal courts. However, the magistrate wanted us to swear. And we told him, well, no, we don't swear. We only affirm. Why? Well, because it violates our religious conviction. The guy went off. He was all upset because apparently the Scientology church had lost a case just that day, and so they were demonstrating in front of the courtroom and the courthouse and talking about their religious convictions were violated. Nevertheless, this guy, I mean, he was almost holding us in contempt for that. And so I have seen case after case after case where even from a legal standpoint, the system seemed to have always worked against us, against the church which I belonged to. But you see, God would always help us. There was one case where somebody sued Mr. Armstrong, and it looked pretty grim. I'm not even talking about the divorce case he went through. There was another debacle over there in Arizona. But this was one where he was sued for something, and I forgot what it was. But I do recall that on the day when the trial was supposed to start, that man went into the courthouse, had a heart attack, and died on the steps of the courthouse. Now, again, I leave it to your judgment to figure out why that happened. All I'm saying is, God has always helped us. And the point is, God is going to help you. When you have to appear in front of a jury, judge, he will help you to find the right words. It's not always easy. We just had a case the other day where it was a close call. The judge finally excused the person, but it wasn't an easy sailing. And we shouldn't expect that we have these easy sailings from now on. You see, what's wrong with the jury system is also the fact that jury members are basically unqualified to make legally, even legally, correct decisions. And so what happens is that the judge is instructing them on legal matters. And the jurors are then asked to follow the judge's instructions. Can't have an own mind on these things. They have to follow the judge's instructions. But what if the judge is wrong? What if the judge is not qualified enough to appreciate or doesn't care about the protections guaranteed in the United States Constitution? And even commentators on the news are telling you that's a big problem. Many or most judges in superior courts don't seem to understand the laws as guaranteed in the Constitution. They don't care about them. So you can't expect them to instruct the jury correctly on those matters. Or what if the judge says to the jury, oh, here, this is a comment made by some of those witnesses, disregard it. What juror is going to disregard it? In fact, just the opposite is true. You will keep that in mind. It shows the problems with this whole idea. And so, people have been held in contempt. There's one case we always quote when we write to the judge of a Worldwide Church of God member. At the time when the Worldwide Church of God was on track and taught against serving on the jury. So he refused to serve and was held in contempt and went to jail. He actually went to jail. And then the case was appealed, and then the Court of Appeal overruled it. In fact, it went up to the Supreme Court, and they overruled it, got it back to the Court of Appeal and then the Superior Court, and then they finally let him go. The judge in that case didn't care about the Constitution, couldn't care less. So don't assume that when you appear in front of a judge, that that judge cares about the Constitution. You know, people went to jail because they were unwilling to swear in court. It's not so long ago that that change was made. There was a minister, a pastor of a Protestant church, who said, no, the Bible tells me don't swear, I won't swear. The judge says, you go to court, you go to jail. And he sent him to jail. It was there, I don't know for how many days, then it was appealed, and finally a decision was rendered that you can affirm instead of swearing. What about those parents who don't want to vaccinate their children because of religious convictions? What about those parents, like we have this case right now with the mother on the run, who doesn't want to administer medical treatments to them, which they consider to be harmful to the health of the child? What about those who want to discipline their children the way the Bible talks about it,
And in all those cases, the government comes in, takes over, threatens to take the children away, making all kinds of charges. You know, all of these areas are constitutionally protected. But it looks like in our liberal development in this country, attempts are being made to chip away more and more pieces of the Constitution until finally we have nothing left than a small slice of Swiss cheese with lots of huge holes in it. Easily, the jury can be emotionally inflamed. As I said, when the judge says disregard it, they won't. If the judge says, for whatever reason, through his demeanor, whatever it may be, you know, I don't like this guy, the jury will pick up on that. I would say this case where we lost $1.26 million in it, we later found out about it, the jury was emotionally inflamed during deliberation. You know, you heard about the Westerfield case, and I'm coming to a close, unfortunately. This is a guy who was charged with killing this girl, and he was sentenced to death. Now, I listened to the entire trial. It was televised. And I had to conclude that if I had been a juror, I could not have convicted him. Why? Because all they had was circumstantial evidence, and it was part on a theory which the district attorney started off with, which he never proved. Later on, the foreman of the jury was asked, why did they convict him? And the answer was because he could never explain how the blood of the girl ended up in his trailer. Well, there were some explanations in the preliminary hearings, but apparently not in trial. But he had it all upside down. You see, Westerfield didn't have to explain anything. The jury could not have looked at that. To me, that's reversible, appealable error, but I don't know what's happening in this case. The point is, he was, to me, even condemned by the jury for reasons the judge should have never allowed. So anyway, my experience has been one of frustration when it came to the legal system. And I heartily, 100% agree with what the Bible says. It's not for me to serve on the jury. The question is, how do you feel about it?